Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org. This morning, I'd like to say something I'd like to talk about Sangha, one of my favorite topics, to be sure. And I want to talk about Sangha, the importance of the web of relationships within a Sangha, within a group of practitioners, and how that might affect us as we go out into the world. So, our core practice in Zen is just sitting, doing Zazen, sitting quietly by ourselves, whether in a group or at home. We have this kind of solitary practice at our core, which leads us, I hope, to recognize an aspect of ourselves that is often covered over, what we call a Buddha nature, just our quiet selves. That, according to our tradition, is always there. It's just quiet. It's so quiet that it doesn't get any attention. And so, with us running around all day, we don't notice it. So we have to get quiet in order to notice it. That's I think, at the core of our practice. Finding this deepest nature, finding ourselves. And I want to say that even if somebody never comes to a center like this, never practices together, just reads a book, has Pema Chodron on the nightstand, and reads and sits by themselves, I call that great. That people can really be helped by that, I think. But having said that, I do think that, I can't help but notice that Buddhism has been practiced in groups for a very long time. It's essentially a monastic practice where people get together in groups to practice together. And I think that there is a dimension of practice which is missed if one is only practicing by oneself. And I want to talk about that dimension today. In this place, when you come here, we're not only practicing together, we're even facing each other. It's very kind of social, that way. Can be awkward, I think. If we were in other traditions, they'd face the wall. But in this one, we're kind of facing together, all one group, around the campfire of nothing. The campfire that is no campfire. I ran into a minister, a Christian minister, who gave a talk here recently. I ran into her recently, and she was so moved by having come here. She'd never practiced like this before. Because when she gives a talk, at a regular service, Christian service, everybody's facing the minister. And the minister has all eyes upon him or her. And she says she feels like she has to feed, people. Whereas coming here, we face each other. And we do this practice together, all facing each other. And then there's a talk kind of as an add-on at the end. Now, she said the vibe was very different. I'm really asking people to get together, to do this practice together. And then at the end, there's a talk. And, you know, some people turn, face me to be sure. Some people just continue sitting. Just something's happening over there. And we do a lot of together action here, which we don't, it's a sliver of what I did when I was in the monastery, but it's still, we walk together in step, we bow all together, we do all these things together. And I think that this together action, the Koreans call it together, in Korean Zen there's a lot of emphasis on together action. This together action has a kind of binding action which is subtle, it's below the surface. It's not just the normal even. Just the fact that we, and I think it's in fact one of the sometimes overlooked maybe benefits of the rituals that we do here, is because they bind us together on kind of a below the surface level. I think that below the surface level is important, as well as the on the surface level, in which we just get together and help each other out. We talk to each other afterwards over coffee about what's going on in our lives, maybe what's going on in our practice, I hope. This level of kind of support, kind of horizontal, I think of it, is so important to me. And even though I practiced in a very traditional way, you know, in America, with a teacher who was the grand poobah, as we have it in Zen. Even though that's the case, and it was kind of a narrow, you know, the pyramid, the organizational pyramid was quite pointy, I learned more from this, from doing the practice and from my peers, than I did from this. Even though I learned a lot from my teacher, to be sure, I learned so much from this, and I didn't expect that going into that situation of becoming a monk, how much I learned from the horizontal. So it's very important to me, to be sure. And I think, the support that we give each other, the kind of web of relationships that we build is important to me. That we know each other, not just as the person sitting across there, but that we know each other as a multidimensional person, is important to me as well. I think that's something that's lost sometimes in a digital society, for instance, where everybody has their profile and everybody has their interest group that they're in, and all you know is about that interest group. You don't know them as a full, rounded human being who suffers and is joyful and has all kinds of problems. I want you to know me. Of course, is that too? It is my, and I think we can support each other in our practice by, and in our lives by getting to know each other in that way, and through all kinds of changes in our lives, good times and bad. It is an image that sometimes I have used in the past and that I like, is that I was a bread baker. I worked for about a year in a bakery, and you know we did this by machine in the bakery. But then when I went to the monastery and I was cook, you know, you need the bread. You have to, and the more you need it, the more the gluten forms a kind of net. And that net then catches the CO2 from the yeast interacting with the sugar and makes the bread rise. And I feel like the net of Sangha helps us all, helps the whole group rise in a way, if that net has been encouraged and strengthened. So that sounds good. It's also a pain in the neck, Sangha, you know, because we're people and because we do things wrong, we fart, you know, we have to kind of deal with each other on all kinds of different levels. And that is also recognized in our tradition, in our Zen tradition. It's said that monks are stones in a bag, you know, and you shake the stones, and as you keep shaking, the stones polish each other by knocking each other's, rough places off. It's the term in Japanese is mutual polishing. So we polish each other in that way too. But in order to do that, of course, we have to be stuck. The nice thing about a monastery is you're kind of stuck there. In a sangha like this, you can come and go. So I do appreciate that's why I want people to stick with something like this, not just through the good times, but also through bad. So I think this together action, this togetherness part is important for us, for all of us. And I've been reading, I finished reading a few weeks ago, Jonathan Haidt's book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Religion and Politics. I read that for a talk I was giving in Norway. And I just want to say a little bit about it, some of what I learned there. In the book, basically he says, groups are good, and they're problematic. And the good part, he's an evolutionary psychologist, he makes an argument that we have a hivish nature, that we're not just, and not only that, but that it's evolutionarily evolved, that we're actually 10% bee, as well as like 90% chimp. And that's one of the reasons that we've done well as a species is because of our ability to work together. It's not everybody agrees 100% with him, but it's not really an outlying theory anymore. And that within a group we gain benefits by within the group. By helping each other, by learning to trust one another, that there's a kind of social capital that builds up within a group that helps everybody in the group. And if we're working toward a similar goal, that's positive, and that group action also kind of strikes an ancient chord. Boiling a lot down here, but he also believes, by the way, in this kind of working, like doing things together. He thinks that's something that builds bonds together in a way that we sometimes underappreciate the actual doing something together. He calls it muscular bonding. And he quotes Robert Putnam, who wrote this book Bowling Alone, which some of you may know, about how, you know, we don't join organizations anymore. And he was an early thinker on this social capital idea. And he says that the more often people attend religious services, the more generous they become, not just within the group, not just to their own group, but also in general. outside as well. And that that they do service to their church, but they also, on average, do more work in the neighborhood and more work in civic organizations altogether. Basically, they're better neighbors and citizens for being part of a group. And this in this study, they questioned them about their beliefs and their practices. Maybe that was what did it, and it wasn't what did it. The beliefs and practices didn't matter much at all, whether they're Catholic or Jewish or Buddhist or Mormon. The variable that mattered is how entwined they were in relationships with their co-religionists. And the way Haidt puts it is, it's friendships and group activities carried out within a moral matrix that emphasizes selflessness that brings out the best in people. So, I'm interested in a lot of things that Haidt says in that book, but this group dynamic is one in particular that I'm interested in. And and I do think, kind of intuitively, I guess, that going through good times and bad times with a Sangha, working toward a shared goal, doesn't just improve ourselves, but also improves our community and our society as a whole in some way. Yeah, so now, but I do want to spend just a moment talking about the downside of groups as well. Because there is a downside to a group activity like this, to joining up with a religion. And that is the in-group, out-group dynamic that can form. Where you glorify your group and then tend to demonize those other guys, the Soto guys. What do they know? And that can lead to a kind of self-righteousness and harm, moralistic kind of harm. I think that Zen is, let me just pat Zen on the back for some. I think in a couple of ways we work against that in this practice. One is that we sit, and our core practice is about letting everything go and seeing through labels. Seeing through names, Jonathan Haidt actually happens to quote this our third ancestor: "The great way is not hard; just give up picking and choosing. Do not like or dislike, and all will be clear." Taking some time to drop all of our liking and disliking opens us up to other people, opens us up to other members of other groups in a way that can be very helpful, I think. And I think probably because that's our fundamental practice, Zen has a kind of baked-in modesty about itself. I mean, as soon as I say that, I think about all those masters who say, just do this and you'll become the greatest person ever, or great the great enlightenment stories. But nevertheless, Zen has this thread, which I like to emphasize, which says Zen is a finger pointing at the moon, and when you find the moon, you don't need the finger anymore. And that goes way back to the Buddha, in fact. The story of the Buddha saying, once you've crossed the river, are you going to strap that raft to your back and walk around with it the rest of your life? No. You're going to put the raft down. The raft is Buddhism. The finger is Zen, is this Zen practice. And Rinzai saying, when you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. That's the same thing. And for us, to be a Zen Christian is just fine. Those are all examples, I think, of ways in which we work. And I think it's good work to to not hold on too tightly to our own identity. But all this Zen practice does not make us perfect. Li Dun and I have a business together, making meditation cushions, selling them online, and all kinds of other things too now. And there was one time where, a few years ago, where we needed to hire an employee, and we chose Mary, not her real name. She seemed enthusiastic and careful, and we had a lot of choices, actually. Anyway, second day on the job or something, I said, you know, we meditate on the clock if you'd like, you know, for 15 minutes. And she said, oh, no, I won't be doing any of that. I'm part of the church next door, the evangelical church next door. Oh, I thought, oh my gosh, what have I done? And I thought of her, you know, she's going to have to handle all these Buddhas, remember all these incense names. And I told Li Dun, you know, I'm not sure if this is going to work out. And Li Dun said, well, she seemed quite into it. And I said, yeah, but you don't know these evangelicals. I grew up in the South. It's not like that. This is going to be difficult. And Li Dun said, well, you know, she actually chose this job. And then I realized, wow, I'm the bigot here. I thought those guys were the bigots next door. It's me that has the blinders on. Of course, Mary was fantastic, and our families got to know each other, and she's still friends. She still writes us a Facebook message now and then saying, you forgot to take the sail down. I believe that it's an important part of our practice to go out and meet people who are different from us. To meet people in other tribes. And so I've tried to make a practice of that. I'm happy to say I'm now friends with the minister next door. Mike, I had coffee with him Friday, and you know, we have very different religious beliefs. Him as a conservative Christian, and me as a Zen Buddhist. But we have a lot of points of intersection too. We're both human beings. We're both fathers. We both lead spiritual communities, and you know, we both wonder what it's going to take to get millennials from away from their computer screen and to church on Sunday. And we just like each other. Well, on Friday he said, maybe we should do something in public together. Some kind of, you know, I don't know what. Yeah, so we'll see. But I just want to come back to my... So there are dangers to this, or things that we have to overcome, I think, as a group. But I still do, I'll just finish by saying that that I value group practice. I did a lot of it. I would. You know, I lived for whatever it was, 12 years in a very tight group. And I think there are problems that can with group practice, to be sure. But I think there are also deep benefits, and not only obvious ones, but subtle ones as well. And I think as Buddhism moves to the West, I can feel that the community, the web of community, has loosened. That's a whole other topic, maybe, that I won't get into, but it has. I feel we're more atomized over here compared to the traditional practice. I don't actually think that's all bad. But I do think that I do want to encourage Zen and Buddhism in this country to remember the benefits of community practice and of Sangha. I also think that as members of a Sangha, it's incumbent upon us to go out and meet people from other groups, people from other cultures, people who do things differently from us. And I think that that's an example of the Bodhisattva ideal. We do our practice here, within this group, within ourselves, in a way. And then we go out and we meet others, and we interact with them. And by doing both of those things, by doing this vertical practice and the horizontal practice, I think we grow and we can help others in a way that leads to a positive-sum gain, not a zero-sum gain.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.